religion, and faith. They are the strongest members of my connection network. This is why it is important to think about specific issues when we try to identify the people with whom we can reach out. Sometimes these reaching out questions help when you look at them by shame categories. Who are the individuals and groups who form your connection network? Who reaches out to you with empathy and support? Who are the individuals and groups who form the shame web around these issues? When you see people who are struggling with these issues, do you reach out with empathy or do you insulate yourself? Here is how Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra answered these questions. Susan. When it comes to parenting and motherhood, my mom and sister are more a part of my shame web than my connection network. They're too close. They have too much riding on my decisions. My connection network includes my husband, my best friend, and my mom's group from church. Kayla. Well, naming the shame web for my professional life is easy. It's Nancy and the work environment. My connection network is probably my cousin and Catherine, one of my friends. She used to work in this industry, but now she's home with kids. She understands. I'm afraid I'm a member of my own shame web around this issue, too. Teresa, I think my husband and my best friend are really the only people I can talk to about it, but they're both tired of hearing me complain. My husband is really fed up. I'm seeing a therapist, and I think it helps. She's helping me make the connections between my expectations and my family growing up. It's painful, but worth it if I can get to a better place. My shame web is me, my mother, and several of the women I hang around. They're what my therapist calls my constant critics. Even if they don't see what's going on in my house or with my kids, I always wonder what they would think. Sandra, this is hard. My best connection is my husband. We can talk about anything except this issue. We really struggle about this. I think he's on my web and my connection network. I'm also on both. Sometimes I'm too hard on myself, and sometimes I'm my best friend. I definitely put my in-laws, my teachers growing up, my pastor, and other powerful people from my childhood on my web. My connectors are my students, my friends, and of course, my parents. 6. The fourth element, speaking shame. There is nothing more frustrating, and sometimes frightening, than feeling pain and not being able to describe or explain it to someone. It doesn't matter if it's physical pain or emotional pain. When we can't find the right words to explain our painful experiences to others, we often feel alone and scared. Some of us may even feel anger or rage and act out. Eventually, many of us shut down and either live silently with the pain or, in cases where we can't, accept someone else's definition of what we are feeling simply out of the desperate need to find some remedy. Shame is a type of pain that often defies definition. As discussed throughout this book, shame unconsciously drives thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Its survival depends on remaining undetected. Therefore, it seeks silence and secrecy. If we recognize and understand our triggers, practice critical awareness, and reach out to others, we can increase our resilience by building connection networks. These networks are sources for the empathy, connection, and power we need to free ourselves from the shame web. But to tap into these sources, we need communication skills. We need to be able to identify and communicate what we are feeling and why we are feeling it. Most of us don't naturally acquire the vocabulary we need to identify, describe, and discuss the actual process of experiencing shame or increasing shame resilience. Shame is a complex language. Learning it requires practice and skill. Speaking shame requires us to develop names and terms to describe some of the most painful and abstract concepts that we as humans have to confront. For example, how do we describe the overwhelming physical and emotional responses that most of us experience when we are in shame? Barbara, whose letter you read in the last chapter, does it beautifully. She speaks shame. She said she knows that when she's in shame, her face flushes, her stomach tightens, and she replays the incident over and over in her head. This is very different from many of the participants who described their responses to shame as freaking out, losing it, or dying inside. When people gave me these loose descriptions, I would sometimes ask them if they could give me any specifics. Often, they would just get increasingly frustrated as they tried to tie words to their experiences. When we speak shame, we learn to speak our pain. As I wrote earlier, we are wired for connection, and this makes us wired for story. More than any other method, storytelling is how we communicate who we are, how we feel, what's important to us, and what we need from others. Without language, we cannot speak our stories. Narrative therapists Jill Friedman and Jean Combs write, "Speaking isn't neutral or passive. Every time we speak, we bring forth a reality. If the realities we inhabit are brought forth in the language we use, they are then kept alive and passed along in the stories that we live and tell." Throughout the interviews, women identified not having a way to explain shame and not knowing how to talk about shaming experiences as major factors contributing to feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection. The women who demonstrated high levels of shame resilience were able to express how they felt when they experienced shame, and they could ask for the support they needed from others. In the following sections, we'll look at the specific tools related to speaking shame. Translating shame. We've all been shamed by someone. As I wrote in the introduction, every one of us has been wounded by subtle and sometimes downright mean comments about the way we look, our work, our parenting, how we spend our money, our families, or even the life experiences over which we had no control. Shaming comments can be direct, indirect, manipulative, intentional, and even, I believe, unintentional. What they all share in common is how much they hurt and how they send us reeling and desperately searching for protection. Of course, when we're reeling and desperate, we rarely find effective methods for protecting ourselves. In fact, many of the coping skills we use to deal with shame only magnify our feelings of powerlessness and cause us to sink even deeper in shame, like shame screens. In this chapter, I'll discuss how speaking shame allows us to express how we feel and ask for what we need so we can more effectively build shame resilience. Let's start by examining the shame trap. The shame trap. The shame trap is one of the most difficult forms of shame to recognize, process, and speak. The shame trap is often so hidden or camouflaged that we unknowingly walk right into it, often over and over and over. When we get caught, we come up shaken and asking, "What just happened? Why am I bleeding?" The shame trapper often replies, "What do you mean? I didn't see anything. Maybe you're seeing things. Are you okay?" We are often so taken by surprise that we repeat the experience to make sure it didn't just happen in our imagination. I've had experiences in the past, one in the recent past, where I had to get snared several times before I understood what was happening. Here's my shame trap story. Right after I had Ellen, I was very excited to meet other mothers with newborns. One night at a work function, I was introduced to Phyllis, another new mother. She was also taking time off from work, and I insisted that we go to lunch, and maybe even plan a couple of playdates. I was so excited to have someone to talk to about my new motherhood journey that the very first time we went to lunch, I did the too much connection too soon thing. Anxious to share my new experiences, I said, "I wasn't prepared to be this tired. Sometimes I just crave a short break from being a mom, so I can get some sleep or take a long shower." She replied, "Really? I've never regretted having my baby." Of course, I was shocked. I quickly responded, My God, I don't regret having Ellen. I didn't mean that. I'm just tired. Without missing a beat, she said, It's okay. Some new mothers have a very difficult time with motherhood. It's not for everyone. At this point, I started getting increasingly upset. Listen, Phyllis, I love being a mother. And I love Ellen. I don't have any regrets. It's great. She looked at me like I was pathetic and said, It's okay, don't get hysterical. Maybe it will get better when she gets older. Okay, at this point in the conversation, I was looking for Alan Fund and the candid camera crew. I was literally looking around the restaurant, hoping that someone had overheard this insane conversation and could bear witness to both my sanity and my love of motherhood. I started crying. Phyllis said, Look, I didn't know this was such a sensitive issue for you. Let's talk about something else. I went home dazed and confused. When I told my friend Dawn about this story, she was shocked. She wasn't shocked about the shame trap. She was shocked to learn that I had already made plans to have lunch with Phyllis again. Dawn kept saying, That is crazy-making stuff. Why are you subjecting yourself to that? I couldn't answer her then, but in hindsight, I think I needed another shot at proving that I was a normal and worthy friend and mother. I also think that it was just so bizarre. I couldn't help but believe that maybe I had imagined the whole thing. For about 2 months, every time I was around Phyllis, I came home feeling angry, depressed, and weirdly competitive. It got to the point that I would spend a tremendous amount of time and energy trying to anticipate what she might say the next time we were together so I could craft ruthless responses and comebacks to put her in her place. I specifically remember one morning when I was getting ready to meet her for lunch. I opened a new bottle of lotion that someone had given me as a shower gift. It was green tea, basil, and patchouli organic cream. As I started putting it on, I realized it was a little too earthy for me. It smelled like mulch. As I was rubbing it off with a damp washcloth, I started thinking, Boy, I bet Phyllis would say something rude about this. She always smells like the Estee Lauder counter. So instead of continuing to take it off, I put more on and got dressed. On the way to lunch, I started planning my comebacks. I think the best one was, Oh, you don't like it? It's organic. I try to keep the baby away from strong chemical perfumes. What about you? Of course, she never said a word about my mulch lotion. She found other targets. I sat at the table nauseated, disappointed, and wondering how I could get my forearm under her nose without making it look obvious. It would be too sad to say, Hey, smell my arm. You hate it, don't you? This was the last story Dawn volunteered to listen to. She said, You need to figure out what's going on. This is getting ridiculous. I remember replying, I know. I'm trying to figure her out. Dawn sighed. Figure her out? I don't care what's going on with her. What in the hell is going on with you? About 1 month later, I unexpectedly ran into Phyllis at the drugstore, and she said, Wow, you look really bad. Have you put on some weight? Luckily, I had the flu. I felt so bad and so exhausted that I couldn't even muster up the energy to engage. I just looked at her, shrugged, and kept looking for my medicine. When she walked away, I thought, Wow, that was mean, and it really hurt my feelings. When I stopped trying to beat her at her own game and instead focused on how I felt, I recognized my vulnerability with her. Rather than staying in combat mode, I recognized how badly she hurt my feelings, how frequently she said mean and shaming things, and most importantly, that I needed to alter my relationship with her. I had always felt bad about myself after our lunches, but it wasn't until I actually spoke the words, That hurt my feelings, that was really mean, that I decided to end that relationship and spend some time examining my own role in the whole destructive mess. Speaking shame allows us to translate our experiences so we can learn from them, which are the goals of shame resilience. We can't stop shame from happening, but we can learn to recognize it early enough to move through it constructively rather than destructively. When I applied the four elements of shame resilience, here's what I learned from this experience. First, I was feeling very alone and desperate for connection around my new role as a mother. I was very vulnerable, and I would soon learn what a major trigger motherhood could be for me. While I was aware that our relationship had become less about meeting for lunch and more about preparing for battle, I did not recognize the warning signs that I now associate with crafting ruthless responses and comebacks. I've come to realize that planning ways to get back at people usually means I've missed a shame trigger. When I'm preparing shaming comebacks and gearing up to be hurtful, I'm often knee-deep in an area of serious vulnerability. I also now know that when I use shame to fight back, it compounds my shame rather than alleviating it. That's not who I want to be. Second, because I was a new mother, I had not developed the critical awareness skills I needed to know what a powerful shame trigger motherhood is for most mothers. I definitely individualized, this is about me, and pathologized, I'm crazy, this experience. Critical awareness about motherhood took time to learn and put into practice. Third, when I reached out to Dawn to tell her about the lunch conversation and she tried to support me, I should have listened. I hadn't fully processed the fact that Dawn is big in my connection network around motherhood. I wish I could have heard what she was saying rather than shrugging off her concerns. Fourth, during our lunch, when I said that motherhood was sometimes tiring and Phyllis responded by saying, "Really, I've never regretted having my baby," I might have used my speaking shame skills to say something like, "Wow, how did you get from me being tired to regretting having children?" If the conversation continued to nosedive, I might have just said something like, "We don't seem to be able to understand each other. Let's change the subject." And of course, not pursued that friendship. Lastly, I learned how to translate my experience in a way that allows me to recognize the ineffective patterns that keep me in shame, my shame screens. This story is a great example of how the four elements of shame resilience work together, and not always in a linear fashion. When I really started thinking about my behavior with Phyllis, I came to realize that I had been using, and can sometimes still use, an interesting combination of disconnection strategies, especially around the issue of motherhood. I have a tendency to use the moving toward and moving against combo. I either shut down or try to people-please when I'm actually with that person, then I turn into the angry, plotting shamer when I get home. In this case, I kept trying to convince her that we were the same and that I was a good mother. Until I got home, then I would act out my anger as I tried to figure out how to verbally skewer her. I think I also displaced some feelings of anger toward Dawn by thinking, she just doesn't want me to have a new friend. Protecting ourselves by redirecting our feelings at another human target, displacing, is a common defense strategy when we feel shame. Many of the participants spoke about getting angry or raging at their kids, partners, and friends, rather than dealing with the person or issue triggering the shame. My daughter is 7 years old, so this story happened about that many years ago. I've told this story many times and thought about it even more. It's taken me a long time to get clear about what happened and why it happened. This is not an instant process. It develops slowly. In the following section, we'll talk about shame as intentional or unintentional. As I discuss it, I think it's important to point out that the motivations behind shame don't buffer us from the pain. Unintentional shame is still painful. What are your intentions? Identifying shame as intentional or unintentional is very difficult. It assumes we know the motivation of the person who has made the comment or triggered the shame. Sometimes the motivation is clear and sometimes it isn't. In the examples below, the research participants believed the remarks were meant to hurt and be shaming, but each gave a different reason for the motivation behind the shame. I've labeled each quote with the motivation identified by the research participant. Under the quote is an example of how we might address the motivation while expressing how hurt we feel by the shaming remark. Every time I go home to visit my mom, The first thing she says is, "My God, you're still fat." And the last thing she says when I walk out the door is, "Hopefully you can lose some weight." Shame as motivation. I feel so ashamed when you say hurtful things about my weight. It's so painful for me. It's like all you care about is how I look. If you're trying to make me feel bad so I'll change, that doesn't work. It makes me feel worse about myself and our relationship. You really hurt me when you do that. Shame is when my husband left me for another woman and my son told me it was because I was a fat ass. Shame is anger. When you call me names, especially hurtful names like fat ass, it is really devastating to me. If you're angry with me or your father, we can talk about it. But we can't talk to each other if we are attacking each other. The very first time my son got an ear infection, my pediatrician said, "Well, what's it going to be, your career or your son's hearing?" Shame as judgment. When you say, "What's it going to be, your career or your son's hearing?" I don't know how to respond. I want your medical advice. But when you shame me like that, it's hard for me to hear what you're saying. In the following examples of unintended shame, the participants made comments like, "I really don't think she/he meant to shame me," or, "I honestly don't think they know better." But again, it's important to note that the participants also pointed out that regardless of the intention, the experiences were still shaming and very painful, and their relationships with the shamers were threatened by these experiences. Again, I've labeled each quote with the motivation identified by the participant. Shame is becoming the cancer survivor. Everyone at work thought, "She can't do this anymore." Everyone at home thought, "She can't do this anymore." Everyone treated me like I was completely incapable of anything. Uncomfortable. Sympathy. "Since I've returned to work, I feel that you're treating me differently because of my cancer. Even if you are trying to help me or support me, treating me differently makes me feel alone and like an outsider. I want and need to know that I am the same person and that people will treat me that way." When I told my friends about my miscarriage, they completely invalidated my feelings. They said things like, "At least you know you can get pregnant," or, "At least you weren't too far along." Uncomfortable. Sympathy. Trying to make it better. "I really feel sad and lonely about my miscarriage. I know women experience that in different ways, but for me, it is a big deal. I need you to listen to how I'm feeling. It's not helpful when you try to make it better. I just need to talk about it with people who care about me." Working our way out of the shame web can be very difficult because, like most traps, it entangles you the more you struggle and fight. To free ourselves, we need to move slowly, deliberately, and with a tremendous amount of awareness about what we are doing and why. In that first example, many of us might have reacted by saying, "Get off my back. I'm sick of you saying shit about my weight. I'm sick of it." That just doesn't get us anywhere. In many ways, it is actually a way of protecting the person who is shaming us from hearing, "You are hurting me," and protecting ourselves from having to say, "I'm hurt." It seems counterintuitive, but telling someone how we feel takes more courage and is often more powerful than verbally attacking them. The same type of honest focus on feelings also works when it comes to addressing unintentional shame. Unintentional shame often happens when people are trying to be helpful but end up either giving unsolicited advice, judging, or shutting down the conversation out of their own discomfort. One topic that seems to elicit unintentional shame is infertility. Because it's a topic that touches many of our lives, I'm going to use it as the example in this section on unintentional shame. For those of you who have struggled with getting pregnant, you have a better understanding of how this works than most of us will ever have. Most of us who have not struggled with infertility have had a friend or family member who has. And most of us have had the experience of having someone tell us, "We're trying to get pregnant. I'm having fertility issues." And then what? This is when it happens. We get nervous and uncomfortable and say things like, "It will happen, you'll see." Or, "Have you thought about adopting?" When we talk about infertility in workshops, it's always very emotional. I've been so moved by the depth of this struggle and my personal feelings of inadequacy about addressing it that I started looking for resources. I came across the following guide and found it to be very powerful. I asked a close friend who has struggled with infertility and is also a social worker to review it personally and professionally. She thought it could be an incredibly powerful example of how to express your feelings and ask for what you need. Speaking shame allows us to tell others how we feel and to ask for what we need. These are the basic requirements of resilience and connection. I encourage you to use this guide as a model. The abridged version appears below. The full version is available online at www.infertilityeducation.org. Maybe your issue is unemployment or obesity or recovery from addiction. We can all learn something from this guide and use it to think about how we might give voice to our feelings and needs. As you read each of these sections, think about your own issues and how this might serve as a helpful resource. Speaking shame is a very personal and individual experience. It doesn't work to use someone else's words. However, I find it helpful to learn by example. The author, Jody Earle, frequently felt the need for a brochure like this one during her own 11-year infertility struggle. She experienced 3 pregnancy losses, 1 in each trimester, and eventually the premature births of her 2 sons. She continues to be a peer counselor for those working through infertility. The guide was prepared by Ms. Earle and the Educational Materials Advisory Committee of the Farah Institute. Infertility, a guide for family and friends. I want to share my feelings about infertility with you, because I want you to understand my struggle. I know that understanding infertility is difficult. There are times when it seems even I don't understand. This struggle has provoked intense and unfamiliar feelings in me, and I fear that my reactions to these feelings might be misunderstood. I hope my ability to cope and your ability to understand will improve as I share my feelings with you. I want you to understand. You may describe me this way: obsessed, moody, helpless, depressed, envious, too serious, obnoxious, aggressive, antagonistic, and cynical. These aren't very admirable traits. No wonder your understanding of my infertility is difficult. I prefer to describe myself this way: confused, rushed and impatient, afraid, isolated and alone, guilty and ashamed, angry, sad and hopeless, and unsettled. My infertility makes me feel confused. I always assumed I was fertile. I've spent years avoiding pregnancy, and now it seems ironic that I can't conceive. My infertility makes me feel rushed and impatient. I learned of my infertility only after I'd been trying to become pregnant for some time. My life plan suddenly is behind schedule. I waited to become a parent, and now I must wait again. My infertility makes me feel afraid. Infertility is full of unknowns, and I'm frightened because I need some definite answers. How long will this last? My infertility makes me feel isolated and alone. Reminders of babies are everywhere. I must be the only one enduring this invisible curse. I stay away from others because everything makes me hurt. My infertility makes me feel guilty and ashamed. Frequently, I forget that infertility is a medical problem and should be treated as one. Infertility destroys my self-esteem, and I feel like a failure. Why am I being punished? What did I do to deserve this? Am I not worthy of a baby? My infertility makes me feel angry. Everything makes me angry. And I know much of my anger is misdirected. I'm angry at my body because it has betrayed me, even though I've always taken care of it. I'm angry at my partner, because we can't seem to feel the same about infertility at the same time. My financial resources may determine my family size. My insurance company isn't cooperative, and I must make so many sacrifices to pay the medical bills. I can't miss any more work, or I'll lose my job. I can't go to a specialist, because it means more travel time, more missed work, and greater expenses. Finally, I'm angry at everyone else. Everyone has opinions about my inability to become a parent. Everyone has easy solutions. Everyone seems to know too little and say too much. My infertility makes me feel sad and hopeless. Infertility feels like I've lost my future, and no one knows of my sadness. I feel hopeless. Infertility robs me of my energy. I've never cried so much, nor so easily. I'm sad that my infertility places my marriage under so much strain. My infertility makes me feel unsettled. My life is on hold. Making decisions about my immediate and my long-term future seems impossible. I can't decide about education, career, purchasing a home, pursuing a hobby, getting a pet, vacations, business trips, and house guests. The more I struggle with my infertility, the less control I have. Occasionally, I feel my panic subside. I'm learning some helpful ways to cope. I'm now convinced I'm not crazy, and I believe I'll survive. I'm learning to listen to my body, and to be assertive, not aggressive, about my needs. I'm realizing that good medical care and good emotional care are not necessarily found in the same place. I'm trying to be more than an infertile person, gaining enthusiasm, joyfulness, and zest for life. You can help me. I know you care about me, and I know my infertility affects our relationship. My sadness causes you sadness. What hurts me hurts you too. I believe we can help each other through this sadness. Individually, we both seem quite powerless. But together we can be stronger. Maybe some of these hints will help us to better understand infertility. I need you to be a listener. Talking about my struggle helps me to make decisions. Let me know you are available for me. It's difficult for me to expose my private thoughts if you are rushed or have a deadline for the end of our conversation. Please don't tell me of all the worst things that have happened to others or how easily someone else's infertility was solved. I need you to be supportive. Understand that my decisions aren't made casually. I've agonized over them. Remind me that you respect these decisions, even if you disagree with them, because you know they are made carefully. I need you to be comfortable with me, and then I also will feel more comfortable. Talking about infertility sometimes feels awkward. Are you worried you might say the wrong thing? Share those feelings with me. Ask me if I want to talk. Sometimes I will want to, and sometimes I won't. But it will remind me that you care. I need you to be sensitive. Although I may joke about infertility to help myself cope, it doesn't seem funny when others joke about it. Please don't tease me with remarks like, "You don't seem to know how to do it." Don't trivialize my struggle by saying, "I'd be glad to give you one of my kids." It's no comfort to hear empty reassurances like, "You'll be a parent by this time next year." I need you to be honest with me. Let me know that you may need time to adjust to some of my decisions. I also needed adjustment time. If there are things you don't understand, say so. I need you to be informed. Your advice and suggestions are only frustrating to me if they aren't based on fact. Be well informed so you can educate others when they make remarks based on myths. Don't let anyone tell you that my infertility will be cured if I relax and adopt. Don't tell me this is God's will. Don't ask me to justify my need to parent. I need you to be patient. Remember that working through infertility is a process. It takes time. There are no guarantees, no package deals, no complete kits, no one right answer, and no quickie choices. I need you to be strengthening by boosting my self-esteem. My sense of worthlessness hampers my ability to take charge. Encourage me to maintain my sense of humor. Guide me to find joys. Celebrate with me my successes, even ones as small as making it through a medical appointment without crying. Remind me that I am more than an infertile person. Help me by sharing your strength. Eventually, I will be beyond the struggle of infertility. I know my infertility will never completely go away because it will change my life. I won't be able to return to the person I was before infertility, but I also will no longer be controlled by this struggle. I will leave the struggle behind me, and from that, I will have improved my skills for empathy, patience, resilience, forgiveness, decision-making, and self-assessment. I feel grateful that you are trying to ease my journey through this infertility struggle by giving me your understanding. I know this feels risky. I'm a social worker and a shame researcher, and putting my emotional needs on the table still feels scary to me. We feel vulnerable and exposed, and sometimes sharing doesn't work. It can overwhelm people, and they can throw up their own shame screens, and that will be painful. When you learn to speak shame, it allows you to pick up on some of the subtle language of the shame web. This is language that is used to shame, and language that is used to defend shaming, when we're trying to explain how we feel and what we need. I'm now very cautious when I hear things like, "You're so sensitive. I didn't realize you were so fragile. I didn't realize that was such an issue for you. You're so defensive. I guess I'll have to watch what I say around you. It's all in your head." And last, but certainly not least, I don't like anything that's brutal, including honesty. Honesty is the best policy, but honesty that's motivated by shame, anger, fear, or hurt is not honesty. It's shame, anger, fear, or hurt disguised as honesty. Just because something is accurate or factual doesn't mean it can't be used in a destructive manner. The shame web is often baited with honesty. It gives the shamer an easy comeback. "Well, I'm just telling you the truth. These are just the facts." When we talk about the crazy-making aspects of shame, including shame disguised as honesty, it's important to understand that crazy-making runs the continuum from what I experienced with Phyllis to very serious forms of emotional abuse. In the domestic violence arena, we sometimes use the term gaslighted. This is a reference to the classic Ingrid Bergman film, Gaslight. In the film, Bergman's character is slowly driven crazy by some of the shame trap techniques discussed in this chapter. I make this point because it is critical that our fluency in shame includes the understanding that shame can be a real and dangerous form of abuse. Again, the interview participants who demonstrated high levels of shame resilience depended heavily on the members of their connection network to practice courage and compassion. Their ability to articulate their feelings and needs made that possible. As you've read through each of these chapters, you've started building an understanding of shame and shame resilience. Some of you are following along, doing the exercises with your own issues, and others are reading and soaking it all in. Either way, you are learning to speak shame by simply reading and thinking. Exploring the issues. As the previous chapters have demonstrated, shame is a highly individualized experience. Each of us must examine our own triggers and the messages behind them and develop our own paths to resilience. But as we've seen throughout the book, there are also some universal patterns that run through our experiences. For example, women's shame experiences fall broadly into the 12 shame categories: appearance and body image, motherhood, family, parenting, money and work, mental and physical health, sex, aging, religion, being stereotyped and labeled, speaking out, and surviving trauma. In addition to the shame categories, we also share culture. In our culture today, the fear of disconnection feels very real. Most of us have to constantly work to feel grounded and stay connected. As we start to develop shame resilience, we will find that many of the expectations and messages producing shame are driven by fear, blame, and disconnection, the culture of shame. In these next three chapters, we'll explore how the culture of shame influences our lives, especially around the issues of perfectionism, stereotyping, invisibility, and addiction. We'll also look at how, despite our culture's emphasis on being perfect and being liked, we can develop and maintain the authenticity and strength we need to practice courage, compassion, and connection. 7. Practicing courage in a culture of fear. There may be no more powerful relationship than the one that exists between fear and shame. These two emotions often work together to create the perfect emotional storm. Shame leads to fear, and fear leads to shame. They work together so furiously that it's often hard to tell where one stops and the other begins. Shame, or our fear of disconnection, causes us to be afraid of many things. The issues that I see affecting women the most are our fears of being imperfect, ordinary, and uncool and vulnerable. In the following sections, we'll explore these struggles and how the elements of shame resilience can help us practice courage and compassion in the face of fear. Perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor. Anne Lamott, Bird by Bird, 1994. Shame and Perfectionism. I think I've seen the movie Flashdance at least 20 times. In the 1980s, I wanted to be just like Jennifer Beals' character, Alex. She was the tough construction worker by day and talented, ambitious dancer by night. Of course, my favorite part of the movie is the dance scene, in which Alex auditions for the hoity-toity ballet school. I'm too embarrassed to tell you how many sweatshirts I ruined and how many leg warmers I bought. Of course, I wasn't alone. Nothing took the mystique out of my secret flash dance fantasy like showing up to meet friends for dinner and realizing that all six of us had permed hair, headbands, and ripped sweatshirts. We all wanted to be Alex in Flashdance. She was perfect. Ripped clothing looked sexy. Welding looked exciting. Ballet looked cool and breakdancing looked easy. But alas, the perfection was only an illusion. I was disappointed to learn that the film director used four different people to create that audition sequence. Jennifer Beals' beautiful face, a professional dancer for the ballet scenes, a champion gymnast for the leaping and jumping, and a male street performer for the breakdancing. All those bad perms, and all that money for leg warmers. For what? To try and achieve some level of perfection that doesn't exist. If most of us stopped to examine the expectations we set for ourselves, we would discover that, like the scene in Flashdance, our concept of perfection is so unrealistic that it can't exist in one person. Instead, it's a combination of pieces or snippets of what's perceived as perfect. We don't just want to be good at what we do. We want to be perfect. We want to edit together all the best clips of what we see to form our lives. So where does this idea of editing for perfection come from? The answer is right in front of us. It's the shame web. If we look at all of the people in the shame web, family, partners, friends, self, colleagues, group members, etc., most of us can identify the expectations these people have of us. This is especially true around some of the shame categories like appearance, motherhood, parenting, work, and family. The primary reason the expectations around these issues are so influential is related to how quickly they are imposed on our lives. On the day that we are born, there are immediate expectations that we will be cute and attractive. We will grow up, get married, be successful, become mothers, have natural parenting skills, and be loving members of sane and well-balanced families. Complicating matters, we have the media, which makes perfection appear attainable by inundating us with images that are quite literally edited for perfection. We stare down at our newborns and fast forward through their lives, thinking and dreaming about their potential. As parents, we even think, I haven't screwed anything up yet. They could have it all. In some families, these expectations are spoken loud and clear. In other families, they are more latent. But regardless of how they are articulated at home, girls and women have these messages reinforced on a daily basis by what we see on television, the books we read, the toys we are given to play with, the conversations we overhear, and what we are taught by educators and peer groups. The powerful effect of these expectations can easily be seen around the issues of body image, caregiving, and motherhood, three of the biggest perfectionism struggles that emerged from the research. Let's look at these issues, starting with body image. Body image. When I first identified the shame categories, appearance stood alone and was meant to capture all parts of how we look, including body image. But as I continued to collect data, I realized that the specific topic of body image has more than earned its place on the list of shame categories. While appearance is a broad category that covers everything from body image to clothing, fitness, and style, body image is the driving force behind appearance shame. In fact, body image is the one issue that comes closest to being a universal trigger, with more than 90% of the participants experiencing shame about their bodies. Body shame is so powerful, and often so deeply rooted in our psyches, that it actually affects why and how we feel shame in many of the other categories, including sexuality, motherhood, parenting, health, aging, and a woman's ability to speak out with confidence. Our body image is how we think and feel about our bodies. It is the mental picture we have of our physical bodies. Unfortunately, our pictures, thoughts, and feelings may have little to do with our actual appearance. It is our image of what our bodies are, often held up to our image of what they should be. While we normally talk about body image as a general reflection of what we look like, we can't ignore the specifics, the body parts that come together to create this image. If we work from the understanding that women most often experience shame when we become trapped in a web of layered, conflicting, and competing expectations of who, what, and how we should be, we can't ignore that there are social community expectations for every single tiny part of us, literally, from our heads to our toes. I'm going to list our body parts because I think they are important. Head, hair, neck, face, ears, skin, nose, eyes, lips, chin, teeth, shoulders, back, breasts, waist, hips, stomach, abdomen, buttocks, vulva, anus, arms, wrists, hands, fingers, fingernails, thighs, knees, calves, ankles, feet, toes, body hair, body fluids, pimples, scars, freckles, stretch marks, and moles. Again, I bet if you look at each of these areas, you have specific body part images for each one. Not to mention a mental list of what you'd like it to look like and the unwanted identities that you want to avoid. When our very own bodies fill us with disgust and feelings of worthlessness, shame can fundamentally change who we are and how we approach the world. Consider the woman who stays quiet in public, out of the fear that her stained and crooked teeth will make people question the value of her contributions. Or the woman who told me that the one thing she hates about being fat is the constant pressure to be nice to people. She explained, "If you're bitchy, they might make a cruel remark about your weight." The research participants also spoke often about how body shame either kept them from enjoying sex or pushed them into having it when they didn't really want to but were desperate for some type of physical validation of worthiness. There were also many women who talked about the shame of having their bodies betray them. These were women who spoke about physical illness, mental illness, and infertility. We often conceptualize body image too narrowly. It's about more than wanting to be thin and attractive. When we begin to blame and hate our bodies for failing to live up to our expectations, we start splitting ourselves in parts and move away from our wholeness, our authentic selves. We can't talk about shame and body image without talking about the pregnant body. I think there are stages to the pregnant body, each susceptible to shame in its own way. First, there is the woman who wants to become pregnant. I heard story after story about the pressure to be thin and in top shape before becoming pregnant. As we saw from the quote earlier in the book, one woman took her own health and her prenatal care into her hands to avoid being shamed by the doctor because she feared she was too fat to be pregnant. Next, there is the pregnant body. Has any body image been more exploited in the past few years? Don't get me wrong, I'm all for exploring the wonders of the pregnant body and removing the stigma and shame of the pregnant belly. But let's not replace that with one more airbrushed, computer-generated, shame-inducing image for women to not be able to live up to. Movie stars who gain 15 pounds and have their stretch marks airbrushed for their "Look, I'm Human Too" portraits do not represent the realities that most of us face while pregnant. Last, there is the post-pregnant mother body. When women spoke to me about their post-baby body image struggles, I heard more than experiences of shame. I heard grief, loss, anger, and fear. In addition to the weight gain, hemorrhoids, and stretch marks, women struggle with the very real and permanent changes that we often experience after pregnancy and delivery. Again, the media is a very strong force in the expectation setting done around post-pregnancy body images. Within a week, we are expected to be back in our low-rise jeans, midriff-bearing t-shirts, sporting a $500 diaper bag, and carrying our children around like the year's hottest accessory. Parenting is also a shame category affected by body image. As an admittedly vulnerable, imperfect parent, I'm not one to jump on the blame parents for everything, especially the mother's bandwagon. Having said that, I will tell you what I found in my research. Shame creates shame. Parents have a tremendous amount of influence on their children's body image development, and girls are still being shamed by their parents, primarily their mothers, about their weight. When it comes to parenting and body image, I find that parents fall along the continuum. On one side of the continuum, there are parents who are keenly aware that they are the most influential role models in their children's lives. They work diligently to model positive body image behaviors, self-acceptance, acceptance of others, no emphasis placed on the unattainable or ideal, focusing on health rather than weight, deconstructing media messages, etc. On the other side of the continuum are parents who love their children just as much as their counterparts, but are so determined to spare their daughters the pain of being overweight or unattractive, and their sons the pain of being weak, that they will do anything to steer their children toward achievement of the ideal, including belittling and shaming them. Many of these parents struggle with their own body images and process their shame by shaming. Last, there are the folks in the middle, who really do nothing to counter the negative body image issues, but also don't shame their children. Unfortunately, due to societal pressures and the media, most of these kids do not appear to develop strong shame-resilient skills around body image. There just doesn't appear to be any room for neutrality on this issue. You are either actively working to help your children develop a positive self-concept, or by default, you are sacrificing them to the media and society-driven expectations. As you can see, what we think, hate, loathe, and question about our bodies reaches much further and affects far more than our appearance alone. The long reach of body shame can impact how we live and love. The same can be said for caregiving and motherhood. Caregiving. I was not surprised to hear painful story after painful story about caregiving, especially stories about the struggle to take care of a sick partner or an aging family member. The most difficult experiences centered on taking care of sick or aging parents. In the mental health field, we recognize caregiving as one of the most stressful life events people face. When women talked about the anxiety, fear, stress, and shame of being a caregiver, I could hear the demons of perfectionism in their stories. Regardless of the words spoken, I could hear them comparing the hard realities of their day-to-day responsibilities to their idealized images of stress-free, dutiful, and rewarding caregiving. I'm afraid any image of stress-free, dutiful, and rewarding caregiving is a luxury available only to those who have yet to fully engage in this process. When most of us think about the eventuality of taking care of an elderly parent or partner, we get anxious, sad, and fearful. In order to quash those uncomfortable emotions, we sometimes convince ourselves that it will be different for us. It won't be as horrible as it is for the woman who sits next to us at work, or our good friend whose mother is a tough case. We try to escape reality by dwelling in the possibilities of perfection. It will work out just fine. It will be a great chance for us to spend some more time together. So when we find ourselves actually caregiving, we are not at all prepared for the first time our feelings of, I love you and it's a privilege to take care of you, turn into, I hate you and I'm ready for you to die because I need my life back. The stress, anxiety, fear, and grief are magnified as shame and self-loathing set in. Are we monsters? How can we feel like this? We're not monsters, and we feel like this because we are human beings trying to manage a major life event with very little of the support and resources typically offered to people in crisis. During the interviews, women in caregiving roles were incredibly hard on themselves. They often sounded disappointed and sometimes even disgusted by their lack of natural caregiving skills. As I probed deeper about this disappointment, many of them compared their caregiving experiences to parenting. They saw themselves as good, kind people whose nurturing skills had somehow failed them. People often make the mistake of comparing caregiving with parenting. On the face of it, this might make sense. But if we really examine the differences, we can see how absolutely different they are and how believing they are the same sets us up for shame. First and most importantly, we don't have the same relationship with our parents or partner as we do with our children. We don't have to bite through our lips not to cry when we are bathing our children. But that's exactly what I did the first time I bathed my grandmother. And I wasn't even her primary caregiver. My mom was shouldering the burden of taking care of her and her sister at the same time. The energy we need to take care of children is fueled by promise. Taking care of another adult is often steeped in fear and grief, especially if this person is at the end of his life or facing an unknown future. Fear and grief don't fuel us. They usually drain us. Second, we live in a society that has put systems in place specifically to support parents and children. Schools and child care facilities are the easy ones, but it's more than that. Tables, houses, cars, restaurants, they're all built for families that are defined as parents and children. There are thousands of parenting books and magazines. There are playgroups and organized activities. As parents, we are given lots of opportunities to fit in and build connection. When we are caregiving for another adult, parent or otherwise, nothing fits. Our jobs are on the line because we constantly need to leave work for appointments and medical emergencies. Our partners can no longer make it down the stairs in our house. Our parent absolutely refuses to move in with us, if that's even a possibility. And worst of all, we feel absolutely disconnected. In order to maintain the energy we need to caregive, we unhook ourselves from our lives and plug into the person who needs our time and attention. There is one thing that parenting and caregiving have in common, and it's not a positive thing. When it comes to these two issues, everyone is a critic. Chelsea, a woman in her late 50s, spoke powerfully about the scrutiny of caregiving. My dad died 2 years ago. It was sudden and unexpected. My family was heartbroken, especially my mom. She has been sick for what feels like forever, and he was the one who took care of her. Now we take care of my mom. Or I should say, I take care of my mom. My older brother is far too busy with his important life. My older sister's role is to observe and critique my every move. About 6 months ago, my husband and I realized we could no longer do it, neither physically nor emotionally. We decided to put Mom in an assisted living facility close to our house. Well, my brother and sister were appalled. My sister actually said, "I can't believe you're going to put her in a prison like a